What is Peace Brain? Peace Brain is the synergistic connection between our mental and emotional bodies, blending the electrical power of the mind with the magnetic force of the heart. Listen and explore how to create unity worldwide as we blend science and metaphysics, open our hearts and minds to the possibilities of peace on Earth, and create the life we are each destined for. Featured guests range from angel communicators to zoologists and everything in between. Now here is your host, Dr. Gail Lash.
Welcome to the Peace Brain Show. This is your host, Dr. Gail Lash, and I'm very happy to have you here today. Today we have an exciting show with Dr. Terry Maple with us to talk about the powerful and fascinating topics of animal welfare, zoos and aquariums, and conservation, and I believe an upcoming book that he's writing as well. And as usual on the Peace Brain Show, after Terry and I are finished talking, there will be a transformative meditation at the end of the show, so please stay tuned for that as well. Okay, but first, I usually open the show with a quote, and today I have a quote from Buckminster Fuller, and I love this quote from Bucky. He says, "You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete." What a powerful quote. You know, this quote to me points out that we must be visionaries. We must think outside the box, you know, for these creative solutions for humanity. We cannot change things by fighting that existing reality, by staying in that negative reality. You know, oh, I've got to fix something, I've got to change it. But we must switch to a positive reality. What is possible? What new inventions can be implemented that not only solve the problem, but perhaps even change our behaviors and our mindsets as well? So today's show is very much about what Bucky is talking about, how we can envision a new reality in regards to the way we relate to the earth and its animals and its resources. When we can be in harmony with the earth, we can survive and be at peace. And, of course, we can more than survive. We can actually thrive. If we continue to live with the existing model of using up the Earth's resources, now without regard for future generations, I'm sure you've all heard of the seventh generation, thinking seven generations ahead in the future, or without regard to the overall health of the planet, we put ourselves in jeopardy as a human species. But if we create a new model, where humans and the Earth are interdependent and focus on sustainable development, we can move actually into prosperity and longevity for the human race and for all life on Earth. So with sustainable development in mind, and of course, just as a reminder, I've talked about on previous shows the 17 sustainable development goals that the United Nations put out in 2015 that are to be hopefully achieved by 2030. So you can look them up, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, by the UN. These are our prescription for a new world, and they're really amazing. So with that in mind, how we can actually look outside the existing reality and create a new model for living with animals and the earth, I actually want to introduce my guest, Terry Maple, to you today. And let me just talk a little bit about Dr. Maple first. He's over his illustrious career, he's had his fingers in a number of different pies, so to speak. He's an amazingly a Renaissance man. And I first want to say that I knew and worked with Terry when I was a zoo biologist at Zoo Atlanta, and he actually was the zoo director and my boss. So, Terry, I'm really happy to have you today. And let me read you a little bit more about Terry here before I actually get him on the show. Also, Dr. Maple was a professor at Georgia Institute of Technology, and I was fortunate to have him on my master's committee on technology and science policy. And over the years, Terry has actually mentored close to 100 graduate students, all of who have gone on to have amazing careers as university professors, as zoo curators and directors, and conservation leaders throughout the world. Now, his official bio part of it goes like this: Dr. Terry L. Maple is best known for his visionary leadership in revitalizing the Atlanta Zoo in the aftermath of one of the most publicized scandals in the history of American zoos. He was appointed director in 1984, and in 1985 founded and became the CEO of Zoo Atlanta, a nonprofit corporation formed to operate the zoo. Zoo Atlanta's privatization started a trend, actually, in the zoo industry. Former Mayor Andrew Young hailed Zoo Atlanta as the most successful privatization in Georgia history. The zoo won 5 awards for excellence in exhibit design and conservation from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, the AZA. Dr. Maple is author and editor of more than 200 scientific publications, including 10 books, and a past president of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, where he established the association's first diversity initiative, worked to differentiate AZA institutions from roadside attractions, and strengthen the association's scientific network. He is internationally recognized as an expert on the behavior, welfare, and conservation of great apes. Maple also taught at Emory University and Georgia Institute of Technology for 30 years. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of the Pacific and a master's degree and PhD in psychobiology from the University of California at Davis. Dr. Maple retired from Zoo Atlanta in 2003 and became president and CEO of the Palm Beach Zoo in 2005. He has been an advisor and consultant to the World Wildlife Fund, the African Wildlife Foundation, the Wildlife Society, the Walt Disney Company, and the National Institutes of Health, and chairman of the Dian Fossey Gorilla Fund International, and received a presidential appointment as a member of the National Museum Services Board. Dr. Maple is currently a professor and resident and director of the Wildlife Wellness at Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens, where he is continuing his long legacy of promoting animal welfare and wellness. Whew, there is so much more history of Dr. Maple to reveal, but I will stop there. So hello and welcome, Terry, to the Peace Brain Show.
Hey, Gail, how you doing?
I am doing well. I'm so happy to have you on this call. It's been a while since we've talked, so I'm happy to reconnect.
Yeah, me too.
So I want to talk a little bit about, you have worked with animals for so many years, and you're so well known as a primatologist and a behaviorist and a general animal expert. What drew you to work with animals in the first place?
Well, I had the good fortune of growing up in San Diego, so the zoo there influenced me a good bit. I did not grow up in a wealthy family, so our recreation was to visit the zoo as frequently as we could, and it was very inspirational to be in that setting. I loved the big animals and always wanted to learn more about them. But I never knew that you could actually get paid to do this sort of thing. I don't know how I thought people were actually running the place, but it was a place to go and to enjoy. I also spent a lot of time in the hills, the foothills of San Diego. I was very interested in lizards and other creatures, and my brother and I used to go up in those hills all the time. And just being close to nature, I think also being not that far from the vast Pacific Ocean was something cool. And all of us who grew up not far from an ocean have a special appreciation for wildlife.
Mm-hmm. I understand. You were fortunate to really be out in nature. That's fantastic. So what did you think about the zoo back then? You just really loved it? Did you have visions of new ways of doing zoos back then too? Or tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I didn't notice a whole lot about that zoo that bothered me. It was considered at the time one of the world's greatest zoos. I think what was most impressive about it was the vast collection, but also the horticulture. As many people know, the San Diego Zoo is well known for the botanical collections and always has invested in that, even though San Diego in many ways is a desert. And, to get that stuff to grow, you got to use a lot of water.
Mm-hmm,
so
exactly.
I didn't think about that at the time. Almost nobody did. But for me, it was a family outing. I guess what that taught me as much as anything else is that families that do interesting things together become even closer. They bond in the presence of exciting things. And it's no surprise that having discovered that zoos generate arousal, the first date I had with my wife, I took her to a zoo.
Oh, I bet you she appreciated that.
Well, I think she thought it was pretty exciting. And
I think she did. No, I mean that.
I recommend it as a very good place to take your girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's awesome. You're right. San Diego Zoo is very well known for its collection. It has an amazing diversity of species, and the horticulture, the gardens are just beautiful. So you were actually around one of the better, you know, zoos in the United States, and particularly at that time. So let's talk a little bit about that. Well, I want to go into animal welfare, but I also, you mentioned about families and really sparking that closeness and connection between families and then also to nature. So perhaps not just animal welfare, but human welfare going into zoos. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that is important. You know, a visit to the zoo for a boy and his father is a lot like going to a baseball game with your father. You never forget it. And, of course, I was an old baseball player. Baseball is played outside. Zoos are largely outside. So that opportunity to get out there in the world and do something exciting with your father, your mother, your family. I have three daughters, as you probably know. So I had the experience of taking them to the zoo. Of course, it was my zoo, the one that I was the director of, and they had a very special experience being in the zoo as often as they were. So I think this really ties into what the movement now, the outdoor movement, getting kids outdoors is something that's very, very important because they spend far too much time inside playing with computers and other things. Nothing wrong with computers, but they need to get out there, experience nature, learn about the animals around them. It's surprising maybe for people who don't live around in tropical areas or even areas like the South. We have lizards everywhere and birds everywhere. And we've always enjoyed birding and looking around at the things that are close to us. This experience of nature is what I think makes us wholly human. And we need to practice it as often as we can.
I totally agree. And I remember as a little girl, there was a pond nearby our house. And I'd go out and watch the dragonflies and the lizards and then the tadpoles in the pond. You know, it was fascinating. It was what made me want to become a biologist later on.
Yeah, that's true. I was talking to my wife about this just today because we were looking at some homes and one of them had a little ravine there. And I said, you know, that reminds me of that ravine next to our house. It was really a wonderful habitat, the big hardwood trees, and there was a running stream going through it, right next to our house in Tucker, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And my little girls used to go down there and play in that thing all the time. And as you know, Emily, my middle daughter, is a zookeeper, and she was no doubt inspired by the things she could do in that stream and in that habitat, because she was always collecting things. I used to call her the bug master. She was not afraid of bugs. She wasn't afraid of any animal. And she liked to pick them up and look at them. There were a lot of praying mantises that she knew where they lived in our yard. She would find them and make friends with them, you might say. She never hurt them. But I think it did develop for her a real love of animals of all kinds. And living close to nature as you did and as she did really instills that in you. And somehow you find a way to get back to nature.
Mm-hmm. And that's so important these days, giving back to nature. And I know we'll talk about conservation as we go along. So with that in mind, with bringing that natural experience into a zoo, then that has been the trend over the last 30, 40 years of zoos, of going from what we used to be the tiled cages to the naturalistic habitats, where you really do bring the outdoors into where the animal lives and bring the people then into where the animal lives, to have that at least as much as we can authentic natural experience with the collection in a zoological institution. So talk about the little bit about what you've seen and how that has changed and how that relates to animal welfare.
Well, there have been tremendous changes. When I was in graduate school, I was influenced by an environmental psychologist named Robert Sommer, and he wrote an article which really struck me. It was called What Do We Learn at the Zoo, and he published it in Natural History Magazine. I didn't know he was working on the paper. When I saw it published, it probably had more influence on me than anything I've ever read. He later published a book called Tight Spaces, in which he talked about hard architecture. The hard architecture is the kind of inflexible setting where you would find a prison, a mental hospital, even called airports, hard architecture. And he included zoos, because back in the time when he was writing about this, in the 70s, there were a lot of hard zoos almost everywhere. He contrasted that with the idea of soft architecture. And at the time that he was advocating this approach, the landscape architects were beginning to change the way zoos were built. And with the Woodland Park Zoo as one of the first pioneers, we began to see landscapes that were very closely tied to a view of nature. I used to talk about this as one of the funny things about John Coe and Gary Lee, well, you know them well,
yes,
who helped design our zoo, and this fellow Nevin Lash, who you also know even better.
Yeah.
They used to draw pictures of a landscape, and instead of the tree going straight up, it was going sideways. And, you know, in nature, if you go down a river in Sumatra or travel in Africa, you see punished habitats, you know, where the elephants and other creatures have been working on trees and different things that happen out there. It's not as neat and nice as your yard. So
that's very true.
Yard, anyway. Mm-hmm. So they used to complain about the Woodland Park Zoo because it wasn't manicured. But the visitors came to understand that this was a simulation of nature. And if it was going to be like that, it had to be legitimate. It had to be a real representation of the world as it is. So we're beginning to understand this now, and zoos are becoming more creative even at simulating them, not just for the visitor, but for the animals too.
And then obviously putting the animals in naturalistic, not only settings, but then groupings. So you have the correct family group, if you will, or troop of animals put together that would be like it would be in the wild, so that they have the natural animal behavior and mating opportunities, etc. And I know that's changed with animal welfare and many, many times and many years ago when that became necessary, and rather than just having these menageries on display for people. So how it has... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It used to be that zoos were more like museums in that they wanted to have every specimen available to see. So they would have animals in pairs or singletons. You remember the days when gorillas were there, just one big male gorilla like Gargantua in the circus. And Willie B, the gorilla in Atlanta, was a singleton. And this was a really terrible thing to isolate these social animals. And fortunately, I was able to change that in Atlanta, and
you sure
zoos
did.
All over. Yeah, right. We were lucky that we had animals at Yerkes that were not living well there. I mean, they had mostly just hard architecture at Yerkes. So, by getting together, we were able to bring a lot of gorillas over to be companions with Willie B. Ultimately, he socialized, and we ended up with one of the finest populations, really the only population of gorillas in the country, and the architects presented us with a really fantastic exhibit that has stood the test of time. We've bred more gorillas than just about anybody. And the zoo, you notice I say we because I'm director emeritus. You know, I still have some stake in the thing, even though I served 18 years there. But it's still a zoo of consequence. And that's because animal welfare, or as I like to call it, wellness, has become a leading guiding principle of how zoos should be organized. And as I've said, the naturalism was originally proposed to make the zoos look better, to make them look more like nature, to give the person visiting there a landscape immersion experience.
Mm-hmm.
But with time, we began to soften the exhibits for the animals, too. And the main thing about an animal in an exhibit is, as you say, to put it in an appropriate social setting. You don't put gorillas alone. They must be in a group. And today, the big issue is how to exhibit elephants.
Yes.
And we now realize that we need elephant herds, not a single elephant, not a pair of elephants, not even a trio. We need herds. And that means our exhibits are going to have to change dramatically to make that possible.
So let's talk a little bit about that. You had an amazing elephant conference that you co-hosted at Jacksonville Zoo just a few weeks ago. And I'd like for you to share a little bit about what went on and what was discovered in that conference.
Well, we put it together. Some years ago, about a decade ago, I began to think about this issue of wellness, in part because of all the concern about obese children. And when I began to read up on that, I began to realize that throughout the world, especially in the West, people were really ratcheting up their concern about their own bodies, their own physical health. And all kinds of programs evolved. People were more active. People were eating differently. And all the kids were being encouraged to be more active. And today you see this with professional athletes who are trying to get kids to go out and play at least an hour a day. So these efforts to try to combat this problem of obesity got me to thinking about it. If it was good enough for people, why don't we do it with animals? Because in the zoo, there were fat elephants, fat gorillas, a lot of animals that were out of shape and, you know, essentially sedentary. They had become couch potatoes like a lot of folks do. And I realized that we were going to have to activate these animals. They weren't going to do it necessarily on their own.
Mm-hmm.
We learned in Atlanta that when you give them a big giant exhibit, they don't necessarily use it. So you have to engineer things. I liken this to a personal trainer. The zoo staff become personal trainers to make sure the animals are taking advantage of the opportunities they have. Now, in the wild, they work and move and do all the things they do because they're looking for food. They don't have food served to them every day. So they have to go out and get it, and that makes them naturally active. So in order to get captive animals, animals in human care, to be more active and more healthy, we needed a kind of overriding concept. And that concept I began to write about when I was at the Palm Beach Zoo is the concept of wellness.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years later, 11 years, I guess, I had installed this idea in San Francisco as a consultant. They had branded the zoo for wellness. It's been working well for them. Of course, in San Francisco, people are all after their own wellness. So the zoo doing it was a no-brainer. And then we brought it to Jacksonville because Tony Vecchio, who used to work for me,
yes,
is now the director. He's now the director. And he said, well, why don't you come do this for us like you did in San Francisco? And I thought about it. It was a four-hour plane ride to San Francisco, but only a four-hour drive up to Jacksonville. So I started working for him 2 years ago. And eventually we came up with this idea, why not have a conference that was a little different than the welfare conferences that had been held. And we took that wellness concept. We decided elephants were the ones where this concept was needed most. And we put together some really fascinating speakers. And it was a big success. Everybody enjoyed it.
Awesome. So with elephants, I mean, obviously you're talking about not only having, as you mentioned, a lot more space for them and a greater number in the herd, but what are some of the enrichment techniques? What are some of the personal trainer techniques? I love that idea. That you can do for the elephants to get them moving, to get them have a better sense of well-being.
Well, my best idea is really a crazy one, and you will understand this because you live in Atlanta. I thought about this when I was teaching at Georgia Tech. I had an architecture class. It was called the Psychology of Environmental Design, and I was thinking about elephants at night because we had put our researchers and our keepers up on the roof at night to observe what the elephants did in their night house. Traditionally, elephants were chained in their night house. They couldn't move around because everybody thought they would hurt each other and there wouldn't be anybody there to help them. So we decided, well, you know, I don't see why. They look in the wild, they're outside at night all the time. So when we tested this, we found out the elephants, you know, took the chains off, put them in there together at night, and what did they do? They had a high old time. And we documented this, published a couple of papers about it. But I wasn't satisfied with that. I thought, you know, we got to get these animals outside at night. So I started thinking about it, and one of my architecture students sketched a drawing of what I called Buckhead Elephant Park. Buckhead Elephant Park was a concept that what if at night when the zoo closed, we opened a gate and the elephants walked down to Buckhead, which is about 7 miles. I envisioned a road along the Highway 75 where the elephants would walk by the cars and walk on up the road. All the students from Georgia Tech and Emory go to Buckhead to drink. So I thought maybe the elephants could go up there and get a drink. It could be a water hole or something.
They could get a Tusker beer.
Yeah, then they would walk home and be back at the zoo in the morning. This was the plan. So she drew this out, and I published Buckhead Elephant Park as a concept. And I did it because I wanted to get a conversation going about activating elephants. So now I'm not sure Buckhead Elephant Park had anything to do with it, but a lot of zoos have built these treks, they call them. And elephants now are walking around the zoo on trails that take them outside their exhibits. Sometimes they're guided, sometimes they're not, but they have opportunity built into it because we've stretched their exhibits. Now, you could do this in almost any zoo by the perimeter roads that go around zoos. Mm-hmm. My idea is that at any time during the day, an elephant might be seen anywhere in the zoo because they're big enough that they would be spotted if they were walking around the perimeter. So this would create for the public a tremendously exciting moment, much like discovering them in the wild. But it would be really good for the elephants. We're learning today that elephants in zoos, if they're given the opportunity, they'll walk 3 to 5 miles a day. That's a pretty good bit of exercise. And if we can get them to do that, they're healthier. So every time we invent something new like that, such as the crawl tubes up in Philadelphia. We also have these tubes in Jacksonville where primates and cats can climb up and out and literally in the zoo, but they're protected from the public. But the animals get a view, they get novelty, they get control, they get out there doing things that they wouldn't normally do, but they would do in the wild if they had the opportunity to do it. So we're getting more and more creative about how to do this.
I love it. I just had to laugh about, we just got back from Tanzania 2 days ago, and they had that Tusker beer, so I had to throw that in. And you're right, all of Buckhead is the watering hole for the young people in Atlanta. So it was that was a very clever idea, Terry, to put that Buckhead Elephant Park walk together. Now, how would you, you just mentioned the tubes that a lot of primates go through and cats through many of the zoos too, and they're protected from the public. How would you protect the elephants and the public from getting together just in the interest of safety? Would you build the road to be, you know, obviously it'd have to be elephant sturdy, the fences on either side?
Yeah, you have to, it would be expensive to build it in, but as I say, because elephants are so big, you could build a pretty good fence and people couldn't get to it and the elephant couldn't get out, but you could still see it. You could also see giraffe in those conditions. And there are lots of ways that you could give people a whole body view of that animal through clever design. One of the exciting things we did in Jacksonville is at the end of the conference, I presented a vision of the Jacksonville elephant exhibit, which if we build it, will be one of the largest in the world. It has that perimeter feature, and one of the really cool things about it is there's a big river that goes by Jacksonville Zoo called the Trout River.
Mm-hmm.
And the architects drew this out to be sort of an infinity pool that the elephants could go through, and it would look exactly like they were swimming in the river.
Hmm.
Now, we've often thought, too, about, well, maybe we could let them swim in the river. Maybe we could actually, you know, build a barrier so they could actually pass through the river. I don't know whether the authorities would allow us to do that.
Right.
But the next best thing is a simulation. And I do know this. There were many presenters there that showed what elephants do when they can get in the water. It's an incredible thing to see elephants swimming and playing in the mud and doing the things they like to do. And we can, you know, we can see that at Zoo Atlanta. The elephants will swim, or they used to be able to swim.
Mm-hmm.
I hope the new exhibit will allow that, because that's a really fun thing for the elephants, and it's great for people to see as well.
Absolutely. No, elephants and water go together really well. And yes, Zoo Atlanta is building this amazing new exhibit for elephants, just for the very reasons you're talking about, that we need these larger spaces and these larger numbers together to make a herd. So I'm very excited about that.
It's important, it's even more important than the quantity of space, it's the quality of space. We do need to give them a lot of gadgets and things to do. Elephants are highly intelligent, mm-hmm. much like primates. I have one idea about that. If you go back to the old Hal Markowitz days, he was one of the icons of of enrichment. Hal built a shower for elephants in Portland. He basically went out and purchased a car wash kit, and he brought it back to the zoo and hooked it up, and the elephants would take a shower whenever they wanted to. So many zoos are building this in now, but my modification would allow the elephants to squirt the public. I think that would be fun.
I'm sure they would have a lot of fun with that.
I think they ought to be allowed.
It is about giving them choice. This is very key in not only elephants, but all the species, to give the animal a choice of where to be and what to do and what environment they want to be in.
Hey, one thing I need to say, and people need to understand this, there are people out there that don't like zoos, and I understand why. But in zoos today, the ones that are doing it right, elephants and other animals are living very, very well. There's no doubt they're living as good as you can live, because in nature they are under tremendous danger and pressure from poachers and all kinds of other problems. I'm not saying elephants should all be in captivity. The most important thing is to protect the populations in the wild. But those that live here, you don't have to worry about them. When we do it right, elephants live well. We just have to keep pushing it and inventing and creating. It's what makes it fun to be a zoo person today, is the wellness idea gives us license to build the optimum, the best. There's no limit to wellness that where people look out there. You know, we don't accept that we can only be a little bit well. We all want to be really, really well, and we should be thinking that way with the animals as well.
Thank you for saying that, Terry. Absolutely. That zoos have changed so much from the past to the present. It is a different world when it comes to, as you said, good zoos, well-designed zoos, accredited zoos that are really doing wellness for their animals. So with that in mind, the future of zoos and aquariums, kind of where are we going? What's your vision? You are an amazing visionary. Thank you for sharing all these innovative ideas today. Where could we go still? What could push the envelope even further?
Well, there's a lot of ideas circulating. Most of them are just expansions of what we see today in the bigger and better zoos. I do think zoos are going to be specializing more than ever. We can't see every animal in the zoo, nor should we try. I think we're learning that certain creatures actually are beyond our ability to create for. Good examples of that would be the orcas. SeaWorld has now given up the idea that this is forever. They will end their exhibitions in the near future. But a lot of other animals that are challenging can still be exhibited very nicely in zoos. We've just got to make sure that zoos are inspiring, that they are wholly educational. I also think zoos need to be places where we can relax and restore ourselves from the busy world we live in. So they have to be tranquil. There has to be a context, a landscape that is beautiful and comfortable and shady, and all the things we can do to create it for both animal and human comfort. And these are really oases, and they should become more and more like that, more of a place where we go to really get our heads together. Not a place for anybody to be unhappy. And I've said before that if we create institutions where people feel sorry for the animals there, they will never listen to any of our conservation messages. We have to be credible. And when you go there, you have to know. You have to be convinced those animals are doing very nicely. And if you trust us, then you'll trust our message.
So that brings me to what we are looking for in the future for zoos to become actually known as a place of peace. And
yes,
peace is a
absolutely
huge concept, but it covers all of those points you just brought up, the tranquility, the inspiring places, the beauty, the welfare for both the humans and the animals, and the education component, because there's so many needs for conservation out there. The campaign called 96 Elephants, of course, is a huge one, speaking of elephants, of that unfortunately 96 elephants are dying in the wild every day, are being poached and used, their ivory used for war and to fund greed and, you know, government war. And so it's, how do you stop those? Well, you stop that by not just talking about how we can conserve elephants, but how we can actually conserve humans and work on the human issues that are underlying the conservation issues. And as a gentleman in Tanzania, we were just there designing a new zoo, which is actually going to be a peace zoo because it's in Dar es Salaam, and Dar es Salaam means home of peace. So the owners wanted to call it a peace zoo in Swahili. And the wildlife experts we talked to in the Tourism and Natural Resource Ministry were saying, you know, peace is the foundation of conservation. So this broader concept of as you described, creating this place that we can all find this sanctuary, this oasis, this place of peace, and then come up with solutions of how to bring that into our own lives and our conservation efforts, obviously, around the world.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and I think you are bringing together ideas about this connection that are going to be very important. Wouldn't be a bit surprised that we'll see more zoos along the lines of the one in Dar es Salaam. And that is a very creative notion. We have moved far beyond where we were 30 years ago. It's hard to imagine what they might be like in future years, but I do believe zoos will be there for the reason that you cite. We live in a cruel world, and there has to be an antithesis to that cruelty. And I think we're going to find it in our nation's evolving zoos and maybe some of those aquariums as well.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So we're getting toward the end of the show before the Peace Brain meditation. Any last words of wisdom for our listeners or things you'd like to make a plug for, like the new book you're writing?
Well, I am writing a new book. It's called Professor in the Zoo. That's probably not surprising. And I do hope everybody will buy it. It's going to be modestly priced because I'm doing the book through the Amazon publication process. I got tired of publishers ripping people off with these expensive books. And so I vowed that I would not do another one that cost over $100. So this book
Thank
is
you.
Gonna, yeah, this will be priced for keepers and students and people to afford. It does cover my career at Zoo Atlanta and the experiences I had there, but it also puts together a vision for what I call empirical zoos, zoos that manage by the evidence, zoos that inquire, zoos that want to know more about the animals that live there. And to be informed, to be a scholar about the animals is going to produce better organizations and better facilities for people and animals. So I'm looking forward to debating with people and discussing with people the ideas in my book. I expect the book to be published in June.
Excellent, Terry. Thank you. And again, it's called Professor in the Zoo?
Professor in the Zoo, and if I have my way, I'll be in Atlanta promoting the book at some kind of event, and hopefully a lot of people who know me will come out and I'll autograph their books, and we'll talk zoo history.
Well, you have had an amazing influence on the whole zoo world. I mean, your career has been amazing, and it's been amazing. It's been fantastic to get to know you. And as you said, many of the people who are now leaders in the zoos today were either worked for you or one of your students or both. And so, I appreciate all you've done and your amazing vision of what zoos can be, what the possibility for wellness of all of our animals can be.
Well, thanks, Gail, but I'm not as amazing as you. You're even more amazing. So.
So with that in mind, I want to ask you one more question, and that is, how can we, thinking about the conservation and the wellness we've just been talking about, and particularly animals in our urban animal collections and zoos and aquariums, how can we relate that to creating a peaceful world?
Well, we live in such difficult times. Although in my life I've seen a lot of difficult times. Certainly the 60s were very tumultuous and difficult. But we just have to find a way to be kinder and gentler and on the people around us, do what we can to build institutions that cater to this kind of peaceful philosophy. I think what's wonderful about the animal world is, by and large, these animals live among each other in a peaceful way. Of course, we can't stop predators from being predators, but they don't fight. They don't have wars. These animals are existing together in a mutually wonderful experience if we leave them alone, if we don't encroach upon their happy lives. And we can learn a lot from them. If we model our own existence to how these animals live, the apes in Africa, all the wonderful birds and other creatures we see in nature, we need those places to stay tranquil, and we ought to model our societies after it.
Thank you. That's an excellent reply. I appreciate that. So thanks, Terry Maple, Dr. Terry Maple, for being on the Peace Brain Show today. We will, I'm sure, have you on future shows. I really appreciate it.
Look forward to it. Thank you, Gail.
So I'm going to go into the Peace Brain meditation now. I invite you to sit back and relax, get comfortable in your chair, take a breath, and give yourself a grounding cord to connect to Mother Earth. A grounding cord is an energetic connection from the base of your spine to the center of the planet. And I like to use a visualization of like a tree trunk or maybe a waterfall going from the base of my spine down into Mother Earth. and really bringing me into that present moment. So I invite you to create a grounding cord. And then have in your mind some really beautiful place you were in nature, perhaps as a child or maybe even just yesterday or last week. And think about that wonderful natural place. And take a breath. And be there in your mind and look around and feel the wind on your face, the sunlight, perhaps the smells. If you're at the beach, the seagulls, the smell of the salt air. If you're in the mountains or a meadow, perhaps the fragrance of the flowers and the songs of the birds. And begin to look around and touch in your with your mind's eye. Reach out a hand and actually touch the earth and feel its coolness or perhaps heat. Caress the grass. See a flower and smell it. And begin to walk in that environment. Give yourself permission to walk through that meadow or along that beach or through that forest. And notice what you notice. Be aware of the animal sounds, the smells, the tranquility, the peacefulness that you feel as you walk in Mother Nature. And invite an animal to come to you. No preconceived notions, just allow whatever animal pops into your mind to actually appear in front of you. And say hello to that animal. Really be in its presence with no fear, with curiosity, with peacefulness, with respect. And notice if it wants to lead you somewhere. And if it does, then follow. And ask it, what message does it have for you today? What note of wellness does it want to give you for your life? Because the animal nations are very wise. Nature is very wise. It does know how to live in harmony and peace and tranquility and sustainability. What might you need in your life to bring balance, to bring peace, bring tranquility into your life? Perhaps the animal has the answer for you. And allow it to lead you to a new place. A place where you actually can hear and see those answers and take a breath and listen with your heart. What well-being comes into your life would bring peace and tranquility and harmony into your being. And whatever message comes to you instantly is the right one. And then allow the animal to lead you into the zoo as it appears right before you, a most beautiful zoo you've ever seen, and begin to walk through its natural environments in its beautiful botanical gardens and feel the shade and the sunlight and see the animals in this area also in harmony and balance and beauty and peace. And notice that they also can talk to you. They have messages for you. Let them tell you how to bring even more happiness and joy into your life. They are glad to see you. They are there as ambassadors for their wild cousins. They are there to teach us humans how to live in respect and dignity and balance and peace. And feel the contentment as you walk through this zoo and the new inventions, the new envelopes that are explored and broken out into new ways of bringing wellness into the animal collections and the humans that view them. And take a breath. And visualize in your mind's eye this beautiful new zoo. And then walk through it to the exit and back out into your world. And notice that your world has changed. Your world is more beautiful. It is more complete. And that your animal guide still walks beside you. Thank your animal guide for taking you through the beautiful forest or beach and then through the zoo with new eyes. And now allow that animal guide to spark in your mind some conservation effort that you would like to see solved, a conservation dilemma that needs our human attention to bring it back into balance and beauty and peace. And pledge that you will investigate, that you will look into this mission, that you will actually take action in whatever way you can. And feel the breeze and feel the peace. And feel the animal guide thanking you for your commitment to bringing animal welfare back to the planet in harmony with human welfare and human actions. And so take a breath again and bring yourself back to your chair, back into the moment where you are now, and you may open your eyes when you choose. Honor the zoos and the animals that are there that bring wisdom to our human populations of how to be in harmony with each other and to really create true well-being for the whole planet and all life on Earth. And take another breath. And I want to thank you all for tuning in today to Dr. Maple and myself and at the Peace Brain Show. And remember, if you would like to connect with me for a private Alchemy of Peace coaching session, or if you would like us to conduct a peace master plan for your organization or company to become known as a place of peace, please go to our website, tourismforpeace.com, or email me at hello@peacebrain.org. And I'm happy to see if there's a fit between our services and your next steps towards peace. And again, I want to thank my guest, Dr. Terry Maple. You can find out more about Dr. Terry L. Maple on Google, because he will show up many, many times on Google. And you can find out about his wonderful book on Amazon soon. The professor in the zoo. Now please go forth and activate your peace brain and put your mark on the World Peace Trails map. Many blessings.
Thank you for joining us on the Peace Brain Show. You can find us at tourismforpeace.com. Be sure to check out Dr. Gail's Alchemy of Peace coaching sessions, her Peace Master plans for your business or organization, and her upcoming book, Peace Brain 101. Tune in to BBS Radio Station 2 every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern for the Peace Brain Show and your next installment of wonder, inspiration, and practical peace.